Good afternoon. I'm Mark Spindelman. I'm a professor here at the College of Law. I'd like to welcome all of you to the event that the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law has put together honoring the 40th anniversary, or in Ron Allen's case, perhaps bemoaning the 40th anniversary, lamenting the 40th anniversary, crying about the 40th anniversary might be more appropriate. Can't help it, Ron. Can't help it. Thank you also to all of our guests. I'm going to turn this over to Charlie Savage in just a minute, but there are a few obligatory thanks that I feel obligated to issue first, in addition to welcoming and thanking all of you for coming. First and foremost, I have to say many thanks to Kristen Blackwell, who has been an unbelievable symposium editor, handling all sorts of details, trying to make sure that the event came off as it has, as smoothly as it possibly could be expected to. Also, thanks to Lisa Jones, the editor-in-chief of the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law, as well as to the journal staff members who helped in various ways, large and small, to make the event run as smoothly as it has so far. Also, thanks to Joshua Dressler, Doug Berman, and Alan Michaels, who are the co-editors of the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law, for making some room in one of its upcoming volumes for the published papers that the panelists will be writing based on their talks. Two more, to Nancy Rogers, the Dean of the College of Law, without whose support none of us would be here, and finally to the speakers for coming in for the event. Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe is going to be moderating, so I thought it was appropriate to give a little introduction before turning the podium over to him. Charlie is the National Legal Affairs Reporter for the Boston Globe, working out of their Washington, D.C. Bureau. He covers the Supreme Court, the Justice Department, and the Department of Homeland Security, with a special focus on September 11th issues, such as detention and interrogation policy. Earlier this year, he wrote a series of articles about President Bush's signing statements that prompted a national conversation, including a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing and an American Bar Association investigation. Charlie was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana in 1975. He earned an undergraduate degree from Harvard College and a master's degree from Yale Law School in 2003. He began his career writing about local and state government politics in Florida for the Miami Herald, moving to Washington and the Globe in 2003 following his fellowship year at Yale. He's currently on leave, on a leave of absence, to write a book about executive power issues for Little Brown, scheduled to be published in the fall of 2007. He's graciously agreed to both moderate the event and also to handle the question and answer period after our panelists do their presentation. So without anything more, let me turn it over to Charlie with many, many thanks.
Well, thank you very much. My role here is largely to get the conversation rolling and then get out of the way. What I'm going to do is briefly describe the facts of the case of Miranda v. Arizona, and then I will introduce each of the speakers at the beginning of their initial 20-minute or so discussion. And then after each of them has had their say, I'll come up here to try to keep the blood from flying too intensely. So, in 1963, a 22-year-old man named Ernesto Miranda was arrested in Arizona for robbery, kidnapping, and rape. He was interrogated by police and confessed to these crimes. At his trial, prosecutors offered only his confession as evidence, and he was convicted and sentenced to a long prison sentence. He appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and 40 years ago, last June, the court handed down a landmark and perpetually controversial 5-4 ruling. This ruling established that police custodial interrogations are inherently coercive, and therefore confessions taken without warning the defendant of his right to a lawyer and his right to remain silent must be thrown out of court. This established the famous Miranda warning, which has become embedded in popular culture in police movies and TV shows. So, this ruling represented by some measures a high watermark amid the legal aid movement for poor defendants in the 1960s and concern over police interrogation tactics. It was controversial from the beginning because it resulted in sometimes in guilty people being let go, not because they were tortured, but because of a technicality. Nevertheless, it has been repeatedly narrowed in the decades since, as the courts have carved out one exception to this bright-line rule after another. Nevertheless, in the year 2000, a conservative majority on the court had a chance to overturn it and declined to on the grounds that it was so embedded in popular culture now that it was, on stare decisis grounds, inextricable from the constitutional rights. And so, without further ado, let us turn to our first speaker. It is my great honor to introduce Professor Yael Kamesar, who is sometimes referred to as a father of Miranda, because the court cited his work in its decision. He is the Clarence Darrow Distinguished University Professor of Law Emeritus at Michigan Law School, a graduate of NYU and Columbia Law School, and he's written extensively throughout his career about police interrogations and confessions. I think that's enough. Have at it.
Thanks very much, Charlie. You know, it was the first time I've ever been in Columbus, but I've spent many an hour in phone conversations with various members of the faculty, and it's great to be here with such a distinguished panel. I'd like to, before getting to my remarks, I'd like to add one addendum to what Roger said about Miranda and the Miranda case. After he served time, he was reconvicted. Miranda got out, and he was autographing Miranda cards, you know, for a buck a card. And he got into a fight and was stabbed to death. And the police reached into his pocket, took out one of his Miranda cards, and read the Miranda rights to the guy who stabbed him. I always thought that would have made the great ending of a movie, but all right. Okay. We cannot evaluate Miranda without looking at the test that preceded it, the so-called due process voluntariness test. Now, remember, at the time of this test, of course, ended to some extent. It's still available. It's still used in some aspects if the guy waives his rights. But remember that the self-incrimination clause did not apply to the states until 1964. And it did not apply to the police station until 1966, until Miranda said it applied. And so this test was around for a long time. And it was also known as the totality of circumstances test because it took into account almost every factor, the suspect's age, intelligence, education, kind of job he held, and so forth. As Larry Herman once observed, and by the way, Larry Herman was also quoted and cited in the Miranda opinion. I'm quoting from Larry Herman now. Under the totality of circumstances approach, virtually everything was relevant and almost nothing was decisive. If you place a premium on clarity, this is not a good thing, unquote. Now, I first grappled with this test back in 1963. It eventually became clear to me that all the talk about breaking the will or overbearing the will was not useful. It was only colorful shorthand for describing police tactics which the court found offensive or which the court thought likely to produce an unreliable confession. You know, when the court felt that what the police did wasn't so bad compared to what other police departments were doing, the court said the confession was voluntary. If the court was upset by what the police were doing, for example, the police sometimes took the clothes off the suspect to soften him up for questioning, the court said the resulting statement was involuntary. When he was Attorney General, Edwin Meese used to say, "We don't need Miranda. We got along fine without Miranda for 175 years. Well, that depends on what you mean by we. I mean, if you mean The police and the prosecutors, yeah, they did very well without Miranda. If you mean the criminal suspects and their lawyers, that's something else again. A good example of how the old test worked, should I say did not work, was Davis versus North Carolina, a case that was actually decided by the Supreme Court the same term as Miranda, but it came up on federal habeas corpus, so they applied the old voluntariness test. The police conceded they had questioned Mr. Davis for 16 days, and they had never seen anybody in 16 days. Yet the North Carolina courts and the federal courts found the confession voluntary. The North Carolina Supreme Court noted that Davis had been told he wasn't required to say anything, and that anything he said could be used against him. Well, they left out something. Mr. Davis was not given that advice until the 16th day after he had orally confessed and just before he signed the written confession. True, when Davis's case was finally reviewed by the Supreme Court of the United States, his confession was found to be involuntary. But Davis was more fortunate than most. He could point to the undisputed facts that he'd been held and questioned for 16 days. Moreover, he had been sentenced to death. And the one time a death sentence is helpful is when a defendant is trying to get his case reviewed by the Supreme Court. In the 30 years preceding Miranda, almost all of the state confession cases the Supreme Court chose to review were death penalty cases. So if you weren't sentenced to death, your chances of getting the court to review a case was almost non-existent. And your chances of prevailing in the lower courts were not much better. It seemed inevitable the court would seek a better way, a more manageable way, to solve the confession problem. And that way turned out to be Miranda. On the eve of Miranda, many voiced fear that if the court continued to move in the direction it was going, and that direction was based on cases like Messiah and Escobedo, it would mean the end of police interrogation. Prominent members of the bench and bar warned that the court had to turn back, that if the court conditioned police questioning on the presence of defense counsel, which it seemed to be about to do, this would prevent the police from doing their job, and this would establish a rule that, as Henry Friendly said, a great federal judge, a rule that our society could not long endure. Well, we'll never know whether our society could endure such a rule or not, because the Supreme Court never promulgated such a rule. Miranda does not condition police questioning on the presence of counsel. Rather, it conditions it on the giving of warnings and the waiver of rights. Miranda allows the police to obtain these warnings without the advice or presence of counsel, without the advice or presence of a judicial officer, and without requiring the police to make any tape recording or objective record of what happened in the interrogation room. Despite this, there was a great reaction against Miranda. There was talk of amending the Constitution. George Thomas has a paper where he says, I'm always defending Miranda. Miranda is the greatest thing as far as I'm concerned. It's not. It's just that I've been so busy defending Miranda, I haven't had time to point out all its faults. Because from the start, the day after Miranda, there was this gross exaggeration of what Miranda meant. Now, and among the people talking about amending the Constitution to get rid of Miranda was a young assistant attorney general in the Nixon administration named William Rehnquist. Even civil libertarians recognize that if Miranda did as much damage as the dissenting justices in the Miranda case predicted, the court would have to retreat. Then a strange thing happened. After a while, people stopped complaining that Miranda had gone too far, and they started complaining Miranda hadn't gone far enough, that it wasn't doing anything. So a new set of questions emerged. How does Miranda's negligible impact demonstrate its success in negating the inherent coerciveness of police interrogation. You know, most people are waiving their rights and talking. And then the other question was, well, if Miranda doesn't do anything, why should we keep it on the books? What good does Miranda do? All right, let me address that. First of all, we're talking about a different Miranda today than the Miranda that Earl Warren wrote. The Miranda we have today is one that has been badly bruised and battered by the Berger and Rehnquist courts. Let me give you some examples very briefly. Although language in Miranda seems to say the opposite, the Berger court ruled that statements obtained in violation of the Miranda rules could be used to impeach the defendant's credibility if he had the audacity to take the stand in his own defense. Although the tone and language of the original Miranda opinion indicated that nothing short of an express waiver would be required, the court has since upheld implied waivers, limited waivers, qualified waivers, and so forth. For example, if someone says, I'll talk to you if you don't take notes, or I'll talk to you if you turn off the tape recording equipment, he's obviously probably confused about what can be used against him and what cannot be. Court says that's all right. Don't have to clarify it. Although the Miranda opinion indicated it would be very difficult to obtain a valid waiver, a recent study by George Thomas, who's on the panel today, emphasizes that it has become extraordinarily easy to obtain a waiver. Moreover, the Supreme Court strongly indicated in the 1980s that the poisonous tree doctrine, commonly used in search and seizure cases, would not apply to evidence obtained in violation of the Miranda rules. So as a practical matter, any evidence derived from a police failure to comply with Miranda is admissible. For example, if the police find out about the whereabouts of a witness they never would have located and known about if they hadn't violated Miranda, the testimony of the witness comes in, and so does the weapon used in a bank robbery, even though the statement itself does not come in. And we know that at least in some jurisdictions, training instructors tell the police cadets just this. The Supreme Court did not make it absolutely clear until quite recently how wide it was departing from the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. But even before it said so, as it did recently, the state and lower federal courts had been doing so on their own for decades. I think it's fair to say that the cumulative effect of the various exceptions to Miranda contributed significantly to the softening of its impact. If so, this can hardly be attributed to the original Miranda, the Miranda Earl Warren wrote. Moreover, there's a good deal of evidence that the police have been avoiding even the downsides, even the exception-riddled Miranda. Empirical studies reveal that at least in a number of jurisdictions, the following police tactics commonly occur. After the suspect is advised of his rights, but before he's asked whether he wants to assert them or waive them, the detective, his friend, tells him that asserting his rights would make matters worse, for it would prevent the detective, his friend, from writing up the case as manslaughter rather than murder, or maybe even self-defense. These field observers agree that the fraud that claims it is somehow in the suspect's interest to talk to the police will forever be the catalyst in a criminal interrogation and a great way to de-emphasize Miranda. Now, these field observers, I'm talking about people like David Simon and Professors Richard Leo and Welch White, repeatedly talk about how the police have adapted to Miranda or adjusted to Miranda. Those are nice words, but I don't think they're the right ones. I think the more accurate words would be how the police are circumventing or disregarding Miranda. Indeed, in at least some of the cases reported by these field observers, the police are making a mockery of Miranda. The police can't use deception or seduction to get a suspect to waive his rights. So far as I know, there is no phase of the criminal process known as the pre-waiver of rights phase, during which time suspects are conditioned or conned into waiving their rights before they're being asked whether they want to assert their rights or not. If this interrogation tactic, or these tactics, are widespread, and I think by now they are, It's no wonder Miranda has not only a negligible effect on confession rates. But the original Miranda, the one that came down in 1966, can either be credited or blamed for this development. The current situation, rather, seems to be largely attributable to the fact that Miranda, modern police questioning, has become an elaborate confidence game. We can't establish that the original Miranda was basically flawed by pointing to empirical studies showing that many detectives have violated both Miranda's letter and spirit. But we can find the original Miranda, we can't fault the original Miranda for something else. The failure to require the police to make an objective record of what actually takes place in the interrogation room. I'm confident that if all the facts reported in these empirical studies were known to the courts, if the entire proceeding had been taped, that at least in some of these cases, as described, no court would admit the resulting statements unless it was prepared to overrule Miranda itself. What the court gets is a signed a piece of paper which says, signed by the defendant, he was advised of his rights. The court gets another piece of paper which says the defendant waived his rights. And the court says, all right, move on to something else. It's astonishing that despite the fact that the need for taping is the one proposition that wins universal agreement in the Miranda literature, only four states require law enforcement officers to record how the warnings are delivered, how the waivers are obtained, and what happens thereafter. Now, I don't deny that there are many police departments which tape the confession. But that's taping the second half of the movie. I want to know what preceded the confession. Oh, they left to tape the confession. But what led up to it? Now, why didn't the court require tape recording? Why didn't it do a lot of other things? Why didn't it require the lawyers to give the warnings rather than the police? Why didn't it require judicial officers to be there, at least be in the room? Well, in 1966, it seems, the Warren Court was barely able to go as far as it did. According to then-Justice Fortas, the court was so closely divided that if the FBI agents had not been giving a version of the Miranda warnings, not as extensive, but some of the Miranda warnings for years, there probably wouldn't have been a landmark Miranda decision. I don't deny that even if the police did fairly comply with Miranda, a significant number of suspects would still waive their rights. I don't think nearly as many would as are doing so now, with all this cunning and confidence game. But one of the leading commentators in this area, George Thomas, who's here today, disagrees. After reading more than 200 court opinions, Thomas concludes that a great, great many suspects want to tell their stories, and the Miranda warnings are not going to get in the way of their storytelling behavior. Now, I suspect that a substantial number of times the court opinions Thomas is relying on filtered out the detective's confidence game tactics, but he could be right, I could be wrong. And assuming that he is right, what follows from that? For example, if Miranda is not doing any good and people just love to tell their side of the story, why keep Miranda on the books? Well, let's talk about that. First of all, let me say this. In all fairness, I'm not known for my fairness, according to Rod Allen, but there's one type of suspect who does not waive his rights. The great majority do. There's one type that doesn't. The suspect with the felony record, the repeat offender, sometimes known in the literature as the silent type. He asserts his rights much more often than his counterparts. But we are told by Richard Leo, who's done many of these field studies and probably knows more about the dynamics of interrogation than anybody else in academia, that this type, if you abolish Miranda, this type would still not talk. Indeed, this type, he says, would terminate the interrogation by asking for a lawyer, even if the warnings weren't required. Now, that raises an interesting question. If Miranda were abolished, would custodial suspects have any right to terminate interrogation? I think they would, but the answer is not clear. There are many other questions that would be raised if Miranda were to be abolished. Suppose in a world without Miranda, a custodial suspect would ask an officer if the officer would prevent her from communicating with a lawyer. Or suppose she asked whether she had to answer his questions or whether the officer had a right to an answer. How should the officer respond in a world without Miranda? Very carefully. I believe that if the, I'm happy to spell this out in the question and answer period. I believe that if the officer answered in the affirmative, the suspect's statements would be inadmissible under the voluntariness test. As it had evolved on the eve of Miranda, the test was constantly changing, generally in favor of imposing more restraints on the police. The only thing we can be fairly confident about is that the abolition of Miranda would cause a great deal of confusion and uncertainty, perhaps even more than that caused by Miranda in the first place. Now, avoiding confusion and uncertainty is not the only reason we should balk at abolishing Miranda. The case has exerted a civilizing influence on police behavior, and in doing so has professionalized the interrogation process. I realize that Miranda may seem like a mere symbol to many, but as Steve Schulhofer once said, the symbolic effects of criminal procedural guarantees are important. They underscore our social commitment to restraint in an area where emotions easily run uncontrolled. Now, abolishing Miranda would be symbolic, too. It would send a message to the police that the good old days were back, or the bad old days, depending upon your point of view. I should point out that Professor Ron Allen, in a recent tribute to his colleague, the great Fred Inbau, who was you know, the renowned champion of police interrogation, even though he strongly disliked Miranda, did not want to see it explicitly overruled, because he was afraid of what that would tell or how that would be interpreted by the police. I've come to the end of my talk. Earlier I asked whether the right question should be, what good is Miranda? Why should we keep it around? Perhaps a more appropriate question would be, at this point in time, what good would it do to abolish Miranda? How much harm would abolishing Miranda cause? I leave you with that.
Thank you, Professor Kamisar. And now it's my distinct pleasure to introduce Professor Ronald Allen. He's the John Henry Widmore Professor of Law at Northwestern University Law School. He did his undergraduate degree in math at Marshall University and earned his JD from the University of Michigan, where he was a student of Professor Kamisar's. And he is widely recognized as a leading expert on evidence and procedure and sentencing. He is also a leading critic of Miranda. Please welcome Professor Allen.
Thank you, Charlie, for that introduction, and actually thank you, Mark Spindelman, for your gracious words as well. I want to be clear that I'm indifferent to whether Miranda is overruled or not. I am, however, not indifferent to whether our ideas are clear and correct. After all, we can learn from our mistakes just as well as we can learn from other things. I'm very pleased and honored to be here for a number of reasons. Miranda versus Arizona is one of the most important cases that the court has ever decided. And it's a distinct honor to be invited by a great law school in a great university to discuss it. And I'm also honored to be here as the guests of the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law and its editors, Doug Berman and Josh Dressler and Alan Michaels and Mark, who I take it was heavily involved in the planning of this event. With the hiring of these people and others over the last 10 years, joining the people who are already here at this great university, Ohio State has moved really to the forefront of criminal law and procedure scholarship in the United States. And the creation of a peer-reviewed journal dedicated to criminal law and procedure scholarship has had a dramatically positive effect on the field as a whole. We at Northwestern view ourselves as having played a role in the contemporary move toward empirical legal scholarship, in which peer-reviewed journals are actually the norm. And we're particularly aware of both the great contributions such journals make and their challenges. And so you have both our thanks and our admiration, and the early returns on the things being published in this journal are very, very positive. Now, unbounded thanks and admiration are also the proper descriptors of the last reason I am both happy and honored to be here, and that is the opportunity it provides to share the podium with Professor Camazar. I have described at length in your journal, and you have it actually in these materials, I just noticed you reproduced all this material, but I've described at great length the debt that I owe to him and the great affection that I have for him, and I won't repeat it now. I will say, however, that the debt continues to grow. To understand this point, I have to tell you one thing about me and my work. My self-conceit is that of a scientist trying to advance knowledge rather than the moralist trying to convince you that my moral views are superior to yours. One of the reasons I'm indifferent to whether Miranda is overruled or not. I'm quite interested in clear ideas, but I'm not so concerned about the politics of the matter. Well, in any event, when I was approached to be on this panel and contribute to a symposium, my response was, Mark, you may remember, I had already written what I had to say about Miranda and the Fifth Amendment, and I see all that's contained in the materials that you have, and thus I didn't have much to add. To which the response was, come anyway. Which, by the way, gave me a little pause about your peer-reviewed journal dedicated to the advance of knowledge. But in any event, I'll put that aside as probably an impolite comment. Anyway, I was, until about a week ago, I was truly at a loss as to what I might say that wouldn't be just completely boring, because I've already said it and maybe it's boring anyway, until, like manna from heaven, Professor Camazar's manuscript arrived. And like so many other times in our relationship, he once again has come to my rescue, and he has many times in the past. And the title of my talk today in the paper immediately appeared to me, which is The Misguided Defenses of Miranda versus Arizona. Now, time is short, so I must jump straight to the chase. The case is misguided for a number of reasons. And again, we can talk about these in greater detail now. I can only outline them. We can talk about them in greater detail later. I can only outline them now. But first and foremost, there's literally no plausible theory of constitutional interpretation that anyone in this room, I would say anyone in the United States, would agree to apply as a general matter that allows one to reach the conclusion that the court reached in Miranda. The words of the Fifth Amendment command, quote, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Nowhere is there any reference to warnings and waiver regime, and never has any member of the Supreme Court, notwithstanding Justice Scalia's provocation and dissent in Dickerson, actually said that that's what the Constitution commands. Secondly, nor is there anything in the history of the Fifth Amendment that leads one to believe that the evil it was directed at was the absence of such a regime, or that any sort of original understanding, original meaning, public understanding, bears any such interpretation whatsoever. Thirdly, no serious argument about the structure of the Constitution generates warnings and waivers as a solution to a structural predicament. There's no theory. How do the defenders respond to this? As Professor Camazar did in his famous, let me just say, justly famous, Gatehouses and Mansions essay. I think, in my opinion, the best thing of among many very, very good things that Professor Camazar has written. But he responded to this by asserting that the history of the Fifth Amendment is tangled and obscure, and that such conditions liberate judgment. Liberate judgment? What does that mean? What it meant to the supporters of the Warren Court, in part, was that one can ignore constitutional theory, the language of the Constitution, the structural elements of it, and pretty much do whatever you, the court, think is right. Indeed, in this paper that Professor Camazar has presented, he quotes from the conferences of the judges where Warren suggests what he was doing was ennobling the police practices. Well, ennobling? And where is that in their job description? There's nothing in the Constitution that allocates such a task to the court. And if there is, let's say I'm wrong about that, it's indifferent to who the justices are. If the court should do what it thinks right in 1966, it should do what it thinks right in 2006. And at this stop, of course, the enthusiasts for Miranda get off the bus. But why? Why isn't judgment just as much liberated in 2006 as it was in 1966? Indeed, why isn't it more so? Miranda has simply compounded the historical difficulties by adding yet another confusing, tangled, bizarre chapter to the history of the Fifth Amendment. Now, I'd be surprised if sometime during the day today we didn't hear various comments about how, of course, the Constitution's capacious language has room for a holding such as Miranda's, and how it must be interpreted in light of evolving, dare I say, advancing notions of enlightened justice and morality. I'll also predict, however, that not a single person making such a point will refer to the language, structure, or history of the document. At the end, then, their claim will be that the court should interpret the document consistent with the speaker's normative views, consistent, in short, with the biases and prejudices, even if they're enlightened. But biases and prejudices, however enlightened they may be, and ironically, to the point of absurdity, the same people will object when a majority of the court expresses different views from their own. After all, either your theory of interpretation is the court should do what it thinks it pleases or it shouldn't, or what it pleases it or it shouldn't. The rest of us, at any rate, I predict, will be very unenthusiastic about a theory of interpretation that the court is to do what it pleases so long as it pleases you. Who would vote for such a theory? Yeah, neither would I. So the case is gibberish. When you think about it from the perspective of constitutional theory, it's just astonishing. Where did this come from? Well, take the case on its own terms. And I've developed this point at length elsewhere and only will summarize the argument here. There are two central problems, and this is the hollow core article that you also have. First of all, it's plainly, and I think we see this maybe only in retrospect, but plainly is internally inconsistent. If the forces are so powerful in the interrogation setting or in the jailhouse, right, the compelling forces of the jailhouse are so compelling that innocent people will confess and yada, 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 these forces will obviously overwhelm whatever effect there might be of warnings and waiver. I think this is probably true, actually, and this is probably one reason why Miranda has not had the dramatic effect that many people anticipated for it, but it's also another reason why defending the case is peculiar. Secondly, and more deeply, and more problematically, Miranda depends on a conception of free will that means freedom from the operation of reasons conditioning the choice to speak. Unless a person chooses truly freely, the choice is determined by its reasons. But the problem is why a person has reasons is determined by prior reasons and so on. At the end of the day, a person must choose to freely, but a choice to speak or do anything else for no reasons, could only be done by an insane person or one in a catatonic state or in a deterministic universe. And clearly, and by the way, the philosophical response to the problem of free will, the most robust one, is to think of the mind as a quantum generator in which what we are actually doing here today is a result of quantum fluctuations in the structure of our brains. But in any event, none of this sounds like the notions of individuality, agency, integrity, and so on that undergird what's the heart of the idea that one should speak voluntarily, if at all. But suppose that's wrong. Suppose that there is a notion of free will that operates here and that somehow we can get some advantage from. Well, if there is such a thing as choosing to speak in the exercise of free will, it's always present when someone speaks. I mean, after all, think of what's going on. What's going on is that your will must make the muscles of your larynx contract and vibrate the vocal cords and so on. This isn't like somebody taking your hand and pushing it down. That's truly compelled. At this point, with respect to speech, it's not, obviously, if there is free will, it's always present in the context in which a confession, articulated sentences, paragraphs, and so on can be uttered. So speaking either always involves free will, or it never does, because free will is a chimera. And thus, any case premised upon it is, frankly, nonsense on stilts. By the way, I'll be happy to discuss the various philosophical responses to this problem. Those of you who you know, studied Dennett, Frankfurt, Watson, and the like, we can talk about it. But there is no defense of free will that gets us out of the box that holds Miranda. How do defenders of Miranda respond to this? When they acknowledge the question at all, they say, as Professor Camazar, and I'm quoting from his paper for this symposium, he says such things as, judges can't wait for the latest twists and turns in this wrong-running debate about free will and determinism. They have to determine the admissibility of the confessions in the cases before them in short order. And when they have done so, I doubt that any of them will have felt the need to ponder the questions philosophers have raised about free will. Now, Yale tells me he actually, that's a criticism of me. He tells me that he's toned this down. I think when we're done today, he'll probably ratchet it back up, which is perfectly fine with me. But in any event, there you have the response. We can put aside free will. That is, we can put aside the very conceptual foundation of what it is we are talking about, because judges don't feel the need to ponder it when they are applying the law. But that's vacuous. The question isn't the cognitive habits of trial judges. It's the conceptual soundness of our categories. Whatever we tell judges depends on a lot of things, but hopefully one thing it depends upon is our getting the nature of things right, or at least being able to explain what it is we are doing and why. The question is not whether trial judges need to ponder free will. It's whether we do, and the people who make the rules for trial judges. And here the point is obvious. Of course we do. And had the Miranda Court, maybe it would not have written such an indefensible opinion. Indeed, I find it interesting that the same individuals like my good friend Yale who are dismissive of these philosophical inquiries are happy to raise the issue of free will when it thinks it helps them. So there are many quotes from Warren talking about such things as the effect of the interrogation room is designed to subjugate the will of the defender of the defendant to the examiners. I take it you think that's a bad thing, but how can you make that point and rely on it if you're going to dismiss the significance of free will? And another thing the interrogation room is designed to do is to impair the capacity for rational judgment. Well, unfortunately, the notion of rationality is just as contested as is the notion of free will. So I don't see how, on the one hand, you can dismiss these very deep problems with the very conceptual apparatus we're bringing to bear, and on the other hand, rely on them when you think rhetorically it advances the argument. So review the bidding. The defenders of Miranda advance no plausible theory of constitutional interpretation of general import that you'd be willing to accept if there were 9 Scalias on the court. And your theory has to be indifferent to who it is that's been appointed. Indeed, they advance no theory at all explicitly. The theory they implicitly advance, do what you think is right, so long as it's consistent with what I think, is obviously unacceptable. Their arguments aren't tied to the language, tied to the structure, tied to the history, and they ignore the conceptual black hole, this problem of free will and determinism, at the center of their arguments. Indeed, nowhere in a typical defense of Miranda is the Fifth Amendment ever quoted. And probably, again, I don't know why, but as Scalia more or less pointed out, probably because its language is a reproach to the decision. What's one to say of such things? Perhaps one would do well to quote Professor Camazar, who in class often told the story of Thurman Arnold's quoting a Professor Thomas Reed Powell to the effect that, quote, if you think that you can think about a thing inextricably attached to something else without thinking of that thing which it is attached to, then you have the legal mind. Well, that's exactly what occurs in these debates over Miranda. Its correctness is obviously inextricably intertwined with theories of constitutional interpretation and the meaning of free will, yet virtually never are such things mentioned in polite company. The external shortcomings of Miranda are so intense that its defenders try to shift the debate from Miranda's constitutional stature to whether subsequent decisions or police actions are consistent with Miranda. Indeed, Charlie got up and referred to cases narrowing Miranda. Well, what do you mean they're narrowing Miranda? A case that doesn't expand a prior case isn't narrowing it. It deals with the issue that hasn't arrived, hasn't arisen yet. How do you know whether it's narrowing it or not? Professor Cambisar refused the prior case's bruising and battering and making a mockery of it. Well, how do you know that? All you know is another set of cases has come down. The prior case didn't decide things for all time, for all purposes. They just have another case that has come down. In Professor Cambisar's paper, over and over again, the question is raised whether Miranda has been respected, whether subsequent cases deviate from it, whether coercion for purposes of Miranda, whatever that might mean, is involved in contemporary police activities, whether its status as an important symbol should insulate it from reversal. But never once is the Fifth Amendment quoted. The argument essentially assumes the correctness of Miranda, more precisely the correctness of a certain reading of Miranda, and argues that anything that deviates from this view is wrong. That's what you did in your, I think, opening remarks. But this is obviously an inappropriate form of argumentation. One cannot establish that one case is wrong because of its inconsistency with another case. Either case might be wrong. What you need is an independent justification for why one's right and one's wrong. From an external perspective, then, the case is an unjustifiable mess. Notwithstanding prodigious social, scholarly efforts over four decades to try to replace its wobbly foundations with something more substantial. But forget all that. All right, put that aside. Let's judge the case on its own terms. As you can tell from the commentary in the case, many of its supporters are disappointed in the effect that it had and many of the court's subsequent cases have done. But why are they disappointed? Why? Remember that the primary practical complaint, and Professor Cambisar spelled this out, of the pre-Miranda era was the ambiguity of the voluntariness test and its failure to draw sharp enough lines, although the real problem, as he is fully aware and we agree on, is the windowless interrogation room, and that problem has to be solved, and I agree with that too. Precision is a good thing, and in one sense, Miranda is quite precise. Give warnings and get waivers, or you can't engage in custodial interrogation. But that's exactly what's occurring now. It's exactly what is occurring now. And yet the defenders of Miranda remain unhappy. Why? They got what they asked for. They got what they wanted. And everybody's following it. Why are you unhappy? Well, the only way to understand this reaction is that they believe the proper criteria are something other than merely giving the warnings and obtaining a waiver. It's the only way to make sense of that. Professor Cambisar himself says today police are circumventing and disregarding Miranda, even though they appear to me to be following it literally. Therefore, given warnings and waivers are not the criteria. But then what are they? What are the criteria for knowing that Miranda has been bruised and battered or narrowed? Because they're given the warnings and they're getting the waivers. Well, another irony here, and it's a deep irony, is that the answer one might want to give to that people should only confess as an exercise of free will, is not available to those like Professor Cambisar who disdain the significance of this arid philosophical debate. You cannot claim that we do not have to engage with the free will problem and then claim that the failure of Miranda is that too many people are being compelled, i.e. not exercising free will, to incriminate themselves. Just flatly logically inconsistent. And suppose this inconvenient truth, shall I call it, is swept under the rug. How do we know whether too many people, or anyone for that matter, is being compelled to incriminate themselves? Whatever you mean by that term. And I'm still struggling to find out what we mean by it. But the only way you could answer that question is by resurrecting something like the old voluntariness test. Warnings and waiver in one case result in a compelled statement, and in another case they didn't because the circumstances are different. But let's be really impolite and push even harder on this mess. Although never spoken, it's obvious what disappoints Miranda's proponents. There are just too many confessions. All right? There are just too many. I'm going to behave like Yale here. Why aren't all those people who Miranda tried to benefit taking advantage of this legal regime, those ingrates? By the way, give me one extra minute on my talk. These people who get the advantage of the Miranda regime should be grateful to Professor Cambisar. He was inspired by, what inspired him was just outrage at governmental abuses, about inequities as a consequence of status distinctions and wealth distinctions. And he dedicated his life to trying to extirpate them. He and I disagree about Miranda. We don't disagree about many other things. But I was there and saw it, and he worked his fingers to the bone out of this sense of social justice. Let me just tell you one story about that. I don't know if you remember this. You were working on something, writing a manuscript, and I was his research assistant. I felt like the interrogators in Ashcraft. It was too late. I had to go to bed. So I left you. I went to bed. Came back about 6 hours later, dawn. He's still there working away, and I go in, and he yells at me, "Where have you been?" "I've been up all night. I can't hardly see anymore. I've been trying to find a word in this dictionary for an hour, and I can't find it. Look it up for me." And he threw me the Detroit phone book. But why he was doing that, whatever our intellectual differences that may emerge over years, why he was doing that was because of his passion for social justice. And I just want to be clear about that. But I go back to my point. Why aren't all these people taking advantage of the Miranda rights, you know, that he worked so hard to create? As he notes, the complaints abound that Miranda didn't go far enough, and he seems to agree. "I don't deny that a significant number of suspects would waive their rights," exactly what you said, "and talk to the police. A significant number would do so because they want to. I do not believe, however," and this is the critical point, "that nearly as many would talk as do now." Fine. What's the right number? Is it 80 out of 100? Is it 50 out of 100? Is it 20 out of 100? Is it zero? More importantly, where does that answer come from? If it doesn't come from free will, if it doesn't come from distinguishing free will from determined actions, where does it come from? There are no footnotes to the Fifth Amendment that says compelled means a ratio of those who waive cannot exceed 4 to 1. And if it doesn't come from free will, where does it come from? Why is an increased ratio of people who exercise their rights to people who don't, who are randomly chosen, I guess, who randomly respond to whatever the influences are, why is that a better world? What is it we're trying to do? Well, so there you have it. At the end of the day, and I'm just about done here, at the end of the day, the defense of Miranda either rests upon the very issue of free will that it supported to dismiss, or an unarticulated, in my view, completely unsupportable view that only a certain ratio of waivers should be allowed. There are a lot of subsidiary issues that time does not permit me to examine. Professor Camazar thinks that the equality principle, which he used to such great advantage in other areas, the problem of equality between rich and poor, and that many innocent people being subject to interrogations even though they didn't confess, matter. Indeed, at one point he mused that perhaps for every guilty person there were 99 innocent people who were interrogated, and the harm that he was focusing on was the harm to the citizenry, the harm to the innocent people. And I think it's an interesting point, and we can discuss these points later in the day if you want. Suffice it to say now, since I have to wrap this up, that the equality principle can't do the work here, I don't believe. And it would be absurd to suggest that 90% of the people that are interrogated today are innocent. Indeed, the best figures suggest that something on the order of 27% of those arrested for a felony are not convicted of something. So that by far most people arrested for felonies are convicted. These points, though, have the advantage of moving the debate in the right direction, which is the costs and benefits of differing legal regimes. I'll close with a few comments on such matters and one other issue as well. Free will doesn't resolve these issues. What sense can be made of the Fifth Amendment privilege? I'll begin with the last point. The only sense it can be made of compulsion is a hierarchy of influences that distinguishes the acceptable from the unacceptable. Straightforward, almost the voluntariness test. A person who spoke under the force of no influences whatsoever would be a madman, and it's not possible to sort out state action from the complex mix of motivations that attends every act every sane act that we engage in. Would we say, for example, that state educational programs designed to inculcate habits of good citizenship and thus also inculcate a sense of guilt in those who commit crimes makes a confession from a person exposed to those programs compelled? The only thing that can be done is precisely what the voluntariness test tried to do, array the forces brought to bear on an individual and work out the line separating the acceptable from the unacceptable inductively. And that's going to eventually refer back to our conventions of what we mean by appropriate use of force, barbarism, and the like, and so on. There remains, of course, the fear of the windowless interrogation room, and it's a serious fear. There's nothing inappropriate about prophylactic court rulings on evidentiary grounds reducing the incentive for untaped interrogations. Or the court saying you don't tape it, and I agree with you, Gail, you have to tape the entire thing. There's nothing wrong with that. If you don't tape it, we're going to exercise a presumption of involuntariness, which is going to be very hard to overcome. A court can decide the facts accurately, typically only if it has reliable evidence. The better solution to all this is magisterial interrogation, first analyzed by Paul Kuiper. This is often objected to on the ground it violates a person's right to remain silent, but there isn't such a right. There's a right to be freed from compelled self-incrimination, not a right to silence. Nowhere does the Constitution even suggest that a person has a right to be free from unreasonable inferences based on his or her behavior, including the choice not to cooperate with the state. The defenders of Miranda, and this is my last point, might make one last effort to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. If I'm right, they may point out, then I'm really right, and every statement is compelled. Thus, there should be no confessions allowed. Not only would that solve the problem of the Fifth Amendment, but it'd give the police the right incentives to investigate crime in other ways. First, this again makes a hash of the Fifth Amendment, which obviously distinguishes between incrimination and compelled incrimination. Moreover, the oft-stated suggestion, and this is a critical point, I probably shouldn't have saved it for last, but the oft-stated suggestion that the police can just substitute other forms of investigation for interrogations, while true in one sense, is extremely misguided in another. Interrogations are a cheap and effective way to obtain information. And for what it's worth, much of what people complain about in current police practices seems perfectly fine to me. Even Davis, who Professor Camazar wants you to think of as spending 16 days locked up, being interrogated 24 hours a day. First of all, apparently he did have access to people. He's carrying around Gideon Bibles that he only could have been given if people visited him in the cell. Secondly, he was interrogated about 45 minutes a day, not 10, not 12, not 24. Now, maybe it was still too much, and I might be very happy to say that's too much, but I think we need to be clear in our ideas. In any event, to replicate the effectiveness of interrogations would entail massive investments in other forms of evidence gathering, including some that would entail substantially increased intrusiveness into your private lives, like you are seeing today around you, not just the NSA program, but surveillance cameras increasingly prevalent and the like. We would thus have to choose between less effective law enforcement or transfers of public dollars from other areas to law enforcement in contexts that would increase the intrusion into everybody's life if you were to match the effectiveness of the consequences of interrogation. There is, in short, no free lunch. It's not police interrogations that are the problem. It's abusive interrogations. It's a good thing that many, many people who commit criminal acts are too stupid or too arrogant to exercise their rights under Miranda. We should not treat the matter of trying to limit criminality as a high school civics lesson in which the predominant issue is to see how we can get more and more people to obstruct legitimate police investigations. Rights are wonderful things, but so too, and maybe this is a right, is the ability to live one's life free from the predations of individuals who have no respect for your rights. I'm almost inclined to say that it's a reproach to the Miranda Court that it conceived of rights as in opposition to the effort to construct civilized society rather than part of it. But I don't think that's quite right. In its defense, the Court saw horrendous cases of brutalization by those very forces of civilization whose virtues I appear to be extolling. And maybe it saw something like the Miranda rules at the end of that process as necessary to bring it finally to an end. And maybe the court was right. Mark, maybe they were right. We need to be clear about our ideas to judge it. Maybe they were right. But that was 40 years ago, and we no longer inhabit that era. We can now see clearly both the strengths and weaknesses of our predecessors, and rather than bemoan this lost paradise, I suggest we learn and go forward. Thank you.
A 30-second humorous comment. You know, after ripping me for 20 minutes, he tells a story about I'm up all night fighting for social justice. What a con man. He would have made a great police interrogator.
Things are getting more lively. Our next speaker will be Professor George Thomas. He is the Judge Alexander P. Waugh Senior Distinguished Scholar at Rutgers University. He earned his B.S. from the University of Tennessee, and an MFA and a J.D. from the University of Iowa, and an LLM and a J.S.D. from Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of a criminal procedure textbook with Joshua Dressler. He's also co-author of a book called The Miranda Debate, and he is currently working on a book about the law of confessions. Please join me in welcoming Professor Thomas.
Thanks very much, Charlie. I'm delighted to be here to celebrate Miranda's 40th birthday, and I echo what Ron Allen said, thanking everyone at the College of Law and the Criminal Law Journal of Criminal Law for making this possible. I want to think about what the law will be in 40 years from now. So the title of my paper is Confessions Law in the Year 2046. And some of you may actually be around for that year. Some of us probably won't be. Miranda, like everything else in the universe, is a product of its time. Ron Allen ended on this idea. The Miranda opinion, not the doctrine, but the opinion, remains frozen in 1966 amber. Think Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Bob Dylan, unwashed Levi's, long hair, Mary Jane, All You Need Is Love. We'll take a quiz on how many people know what Mary Jane means. The baby boomers were coming of age. JFK had rekindled enthusiasm for government. LBJ had delivered, from Texas, had delivered the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and then crushed Barry Goldwater to bring us the Voting Rights Act of 65, Medicare, Medicaid, the War on Poverty, and a nascent welfare state. As 1966 dawned, Americans put their faith in government. It was there to protect us from the evil Soviet Union. It was there to make our lives better. It had taken us a shameful century to insist that the Civil War amendments mean what they actually say. But in 1966, blacks, as well as women and poor, were by law the equal of the white male middle class. And the Warren Court played an important role in this great historic tide. Its role was to give meaning in the law to the notion of equality and the notion of inclusion. Outside the criminal process, we saw the Warren Court uphold the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, give women rights against discrimination, protect freedom of expression, the right to practice religion. The Warren Court proclaimed one man, one vote, though surely it meant one person, one vote. The Warren Court saw the criminal process as no different from the ballot box or the workplace. The norms that mattered were equality and inclusion. Think Yale Kamisar's work. In majestic language in Gideon v. Wainwright, for example, the court ended the day when, quote, the poor man charged with crime had to face his accusers without a lawyer to assist him, end quote. A noble idea that so far has pretty much eluded us in the implementation. But the toughest nut to crack was finding a way to regulate police interrogation. As Ron Allen noted, it is a black hole. And no light escapes from that black hole, at least no light that we can be sure is true. But what the court in 1966 could see at the event horizon of the black hole was disturbing. The event horizon, I like physics. I don't understand it, but I like it. The event horizon of a black hole is the point where light is too far away to be sucked in and not far enough away to escape, and it's literally frozen in space. So at the black hole of the police interrogation, we see the following. A defendant testifies that the police interrogated him for 36 hours, beat him black and blue, and then days later, one of the officers who beat him shows up to say, if you don't confess, I'll beat you again. Now, the police denied this story, but that's my point about no verifiable truth escaping the black hole. In another case, authorities admitted questioning the suspect for 36 consecutive hours. Chicago police told a suspect she could keep her children if she cooperated. This is my favorite. An Arkansas police chief told a suspect that a lynch mob was outside, quote, wanting to get you. But the chief would, quote, try to keep them out if the suspect wanted to confess. A series of cases from the South pitted poorly educated blacks being interrogated by white officers who relentlessly pursued a confession. The mere presence of white law officers in a small interrogation room must have been in the Deep South, must have been terrifying to young black men. Given this event horizon, the court's solution in Miranda is truly puzzling. At least it is looking back 40 years. If abuse of power was the problem, why would warnings and waiver change anything? Indeed, Justice White in his dissent said, quote, those who use third-degree tactics and deny them in court are equally able and destined to lie as skillfully about warnings and waiver, end quote. Well, I mean, that seems right. I think that's part of what Yale is complaining about. To solve the problem seen on the event horizon appeared to require stronger medicine. Ban confessions, require lawyers be in the room. But you must remember to use your 1966 eyes. The Beatles told us all we needed was love. LBJ told us that government could end racism and poverty. Medicare and Medicaid began July 1, 1966. The Sound of Music won the Oscar for Best Film. A Taste of Honey won the Grammy for Best Song. So the five members of the Miranda majority, simply as an act of faith, I think believed two things that we may fairly doubt today. I think first they believed that suspects who felt pressure from the police would invoke their rights as soon as the pressure became too much. And second, I think they believed that the police would play it straight with the suspects and tell the courts more or less what went on. As to the first proposition, we now have solid evidence that suspects either waive in the beginning, about 80% do, or never talk at all. There are very, very, very few suspects, less than 1%, actually endure some interrogation and then later shut it down. So it doesn't seem to be the added pressure that makes them invoke. They either decide they're going to talk or they decide they're not going to talk. As to whether the police play it straight, we don't have any evidence because the black hole is still black, except in the few jurisdictions that require videotaping. But the cases we see today on the event horizon of the black hole suggest that police interrogations are not exactly tea parties. As Yale has pointed out, Miranda was not a revolution. It was a compromise. It was a quintessential 1966 compromise. Humans matter. They should be treated fairly. They have free will. They can exercise that free will. The rich man should have no greater right to fend off police interrogation than the poor black kid in Mississippi. Yale Kamizar stated the equality-based norm of this proposition the year before Miranda and did it much more colorfully than the court did. Quote, to the extent the Constitution permits the wealthy and educated to defeat justice, if you will, why shouldn't all defendants be given a like opportunity? The Miranda concern with dignitary and autonomy interests of suspects is, I have argued, quintessentially 1960s, frozen in the Beatles' amber. But today is 2006. Today we have irrefutable DNA evidence that innocent suspects confess, as odd as that sounds to us, including the men falsely convicted of the rape of the Central Park jogger. In my forthcoming book, Reclaiming Innocence from Judicial Neglect, I use a study of DNA evidence and arrest data to estimate as many as 100,000 convictions a year are convictions of innocent people. To be sure, most are misdemeanor convictions, but nonetheless. A substantial number of these false convictions will involve false confessions. Three overlapping norms, and Larry Herman has written about this very eloquently, three overlapping due process norms evolved in the American law of interrogation. Police should be fair. The suspect's autonomy should be respected. And false confessions must be avoided. Now, take one example that violates all three of those norms is torture. Torture is obviously unfair. The suspect's autonomy is rejected as irrelevant, and many of the confessions will be false. But once we move away from torture, applying the autonomy and fairness norms is actually quite difficult. Now, to show you this, assume we have a universe of confessions and an epistemology that allows us to know for sure which ones are false. So let's start with the subuniverse of true confessions of guilt. Now, we know this suspect is guilty, so we don't have to worry about getting a false confession. Some of these cases will generate a consensus that the police methods are unfair, or they trench too harshly on the suspect's autonomy. Take, for example, the Ashcraft case, where the police interrogated the suspect for 36 consecutive hours. But most cases will sharply divide us on the autonomy and fairness issue. What if police interrogate a suspect for 36 hours, but he doesn't confess? A few days later, they interrogate him for 10 more hours. At the end of the 10-hour interrogation, he confesses, but he says he did it because his accomplice had confessed. And he wanted the police, his good friend, the police detective, to hear his side of the story. Is that involuntary? Well, on Ron Allen's account, all confessions are either voluntary or involuntary. And I have a feeling that my friend Joshua Dressler would say that 46 hours is too much, it's involuntary, but I'm not sure. By his own words, he confessed because he wanted to tell his side of the story. So I think we argue a lot about fairness and autonomy norms. What we don't argue about is admitting false confessions. So now we move to the subuniverse of confessions we know to be false. Well, there's simply no rationale to introduce those confessions. So it follows from that, I think, that the single value that is most important in due process when the issue is police interrogation is to keep from eliciting false statements of guilt from innocent suspects. Of course, we lack an epistemology that allows us always to be certain whether a confession is true or false. So I think due process demands a set of procedures that create an acceptably low risk of false confessions. In case A, the police used the third degree and beat the suspect with that Detroit phone book until, racked with pain, he confesses. In case B, the police lie to the suspect and say, "Your fingerprints were found at the scene of the crime." Now, in both of those cases, I think autonomy and fairness norms have been violated. But the difference, of course, is that beating someone with the Detroit phone book creates an unacceptably high risk that the confession is false, and the trick does not. And courts recognize this difference. The confession in case A is not going to be admitted. The one in case B probably will be. To be sure, the case A, case B hypo is old news. In 1949, Jerome Frank wrote the following, quote, "To our shame," about the third degree, quote, "To our shame be it said that the English, who do not use the third degree, call it the American method of interrogation." So what you want to know, what I want to know, is about the future. And I promised you some revelations about the law of confessions in the year 2046. Of course, that was largely just a tease. Because 40 years ago, in 1966, we would have had no way to predict the DNA evidence would give us powerful and conclusive proof of guilt or innocence. Alvin Toffler and others have suggested that the pace of change in technology is ever increasing. So I don't think anybody can tell us today what technology will be like in the year 2046. I don't even, you know, when I grew up, we didn't even have BlackBerries, if you can imagine such a world. So the procedures we'll use to determine innocence in the year 2046, I think, are unknown to us. But one general fact, almost sure, is that it will involve science. Do you remember Woody Allen's movie Sleeper? Remember the booth that they call the Orgasmatron? Well, imagine a similar booth that a suspect would go in, and the booth will tell us there'll be a reading of innocent or guilty. Now, and let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that this is 100% accurate. Now, one issue would be whether the Fifth Amendment privilege will permit the police to force suspects into our truth machine booth. Well, depending on how the machine detects innocence, it might be true under Smurber v. California that this is constitutional. I'll have to get Yale's opinion about this. Smurber held that compelling a DUI blood test did not violate the privilege because it did not compel the suspect to reveal a thought. Perhaps probing my memory doesn't compel me to reveal a thought either. It's simply probing my memory banks. I grant you, it seems more intrusive to probe my memory than to take my blood. And I promised on this trip not to upset Yale Camazar any more than necessary. So I'm going to concede for the sake of argument that forcing a suspect into the booth would violate the Fifth, would constitute self-incrimination. But today we live in a brave new world with Chavez versus Martinez. Chavez held that the Fifth Amendment is not violated until the statements compelled are introduced in a criminal case against the suspect. So in the year 2046 with my truth machine, we can force a suspect into the booth and find out whether he's innocent or guilty. If he's innocent, then just like Woody Allen in the movie, looking dazed and pleased once he escaped the orgasmatron, our innocent suspect could walk free. And we know the others are guilty, so the police can simply resort to old-fashioned police methods to get the evidence from them. It may seem that I have solved all problems. Speakers always want it to seem as if we have solved all problems. But Peter Henning, a friend of mine at Wayne State, pointed out to me that I'm using innocence here as an undisputed fact in the universe. I either killed my enemy or I did not. But what if the issue is mens rea? You remember your crim law. That fact in the universe is fuzzier. And for a really fuzzy one, what if we're dealing with white-collar crime? Is there even a fact in the universe about whether one has conspired to restrain trade? I doubt it. Well, that suggests that a truth machine, as I have posited, may not ever be possible. But I'm going to be optimistic. What if we have a machine that can give us the following information? It can tell us whether there is an undisputed fact in the universe about guilt, and if the suspect is innocent, the green light will flash innocent. And if the machine's not sure, because it doesn't know much about white-collar crime, it'll say unknown. Well, this is less helpful than my original hypothesis or hypothetical, but still it gets innocent suspects out of harm's way, so it's better than nothing. And the police will still then have to sort out the unknowns and figure out which are guilty and which are innocent. That suggests that my new or revised version of the truth machine is not all we need. What else do we need? Well, we need videotapes. Everybody has said that, and it's certainly true. And I agree that we need to videotape the entire interrogation. There is a problem that's been pointed out in the literature. What about the bad apple cop? What about the corrupt cop, the evil cop, who wants to circumvent the rule? Is there a way to do it? Well, sure. You simply get the suspect into a room and you show him a baseball bat and you say, if you don't confess on tape, I'm going to beat you with this baseball bat. Now, some people have come up with solutions, technological solutions, like interrogation can only occur in a room that where the videotape machine is triggered by motion, but I think all of those technological solutions can be circumvented. I offer here today a low-tech solution to the videotaping problem that, together with my truth machine, will set us free in the year 2046. Why not require, before interrogation can begin, that the suspect confer with, say, a clerk from the judge's office? And the clerk would ask, have the police threatened you? Have they promised any benefits? And this conference could be videotaped itself, could be made part of the record, given to the judge. It seems to me suspects who have been threatened would be quite likely to disclose that to a clerk from the judge's office. The graver the threat, the more likely they would be to disclose. And further, it seems to me that with this regime in place, the bad apple cop is simply not going to make that threat. It's too dangerous to his pension to make that sort of threat. So I think requiring a conference with the clerk before the videotaping begins could be a solution to the problem of cops trying to circumvent. So in sum, I think in 2046, the law of confessions will be much different. Miranda won't really be very important, and I, like Ron Allen, am indifferent to whether it's overruled or not. I guess I'm not. I guess I agree with Yale that overruling it would send a bad message. So sure, leave Miranda on the books for whatever good it does. I don't think it does much harm. So with all respect to Yale and Larry Herman and other people, Miranda is not the end of the line for the law of confessions. Everything changes with time, including law. The law of confessions has seen dramatic changes in the last three centuries, and it's going to change again. So what I would like to see are truth machines. Thank you very much.
Our last speaker is Judge Gerard Lynch. He is the Paul J. Kellner Professor of Law at Columbia University, where he spent most of his career, starting by receiving his BA and his JD. He is a criminal law specialist, a former prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, where he was the chief of the criminal division from 1990 to 1992. He was also part earlier of the Iran-Contra investigation. He was appointed a district judge for the Southern District of New York in 2000 and recently had a bit of tabloid fame when he presided over the perjury trial of the rapper Lil' Kim in 2005, where he immeasurably helped her career by sentencing her to 366 days in jail. Please welcome Judge Lynch.
Did you ever see the headline of your New York Times obituary more clearly than that? Lynch, district judge, dies at 103. Sentenced Lil' Kim. I'm delighted to be here today. I'm delighted to be at Ohio State, which has built a truly extraordinary criminal law and procedure faculty in recent years. Ron Allen already has made that point, so I won't go on to point out all those folks, but I will want to say something else. I'm also delighted because I'm sure that this faculty has the highest per capita number of my former students, including Sharon Davies and Alan Michaels, who are part of that distinguished criminal law faculty, and also including Ned Foley and Debbie Jones Merritt, who is quite literally a daughter of Columbia, my home institution. I'm also delighted to be on a panel with such distinguished colleagues in the criminal law field. But it's also intimidating. What can I say about Miranda in the presence of such a distinguished group of scholars who have studied this subject far more deeply than I have? My main teaching and scholarly interests have concerned substantive criminal law and the courtroom aspects of criminal procedure as opposed to questions of police investigation. And here we have the father of Miranda, the man who would be its undertaker, and the man who probably knows more about the empirical aspects of what actually happens as an effect of Miranda than anybody else in the legal academy. Needless to say, I have to change the topic a little bit to something that I may know more about, and I started to think about what can I contribute from the perspective of a judge. Judges like to think they know more than academics about the real world, but of course they're wrong. We see only a narrow slice of the real world. We see the slice that takes place in courtrooms. We don't know necessarily very much about what happens in police stations and on back roads. I'm not sure academics do either. Some of this is, as Professor Thomas suggests, a black hole that is very hard to get access to, but I suspect that someone who does extensive interviewing of police and of prisoners, someone who observes police interrogations, someone who does a broad sociological study, has a better sense of that than what you can get in a courtroom. It's my job very often to decide the facts of what took place in a police-citizen encounter. I preside over these suppression hearings, and I have to make findings of fact. Now, the problem with this is that typically, in such a case, it is rather more than 50% likely that the police version of what went on is true, or at least so it seems to me. But if it were 51% or even 60% or even 70% likely that the police version is the truth in all of the cases, it's still not 100% likely in any of the cases that the police version is true. And there must be a very substantial collective rate of error on the part of courts attempting to find these facts. So I'm not sure how often the police play it straight. Though I'll say a little more about this later, I think they may be playing it. There is some reason to think that they play it a little straighter than they once did. I do know something about what happens in courtrooms and what judges are asked to decide. The question I want to ask today is stimulated by looking at what I'm typically asked to decide in suppression motions these days. There aren't that many motions about Miranda, and when there are, the cases are not that hard to decide for just the reasons that several of the speakers have alluded to. We have this warning and waiver regime. One thing that we know about the police playing it straight, at least to this extent, they do give the warnings. How do we know that? Because in almost every case we have a signed document from the defendant where the defendant acknowledges the warnings. Now, okay, maybe not all of those defendants speak or read English. Many of those have signed it in Spanish, having been given a document in their own language. I don't know about the TWI speakers. We see a number of those interrogated at Kennedy Airport coming from Africa. Maybe they don't get a Miranda card in their language, but most of our defendants do, and they sign it. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of free will and the voluntariness of their confessions, but it suggests to me that at least what Miranda requires, the minimum that it requires, is being complied with, and that's no lie. What I am asked to decide very often, though, remarkably often, is a question of whether a defendant has consented to a search without a warrant and without probable cause. And the question I want to ask is, why not a Miranda for searches? I'd like to put this. I mean, these cases are enormously common. Next to the automobile exception, the consent exception is the largest category of warrantless searches that produce evidence, and it is by far the largest category of searches without probable cause that yield evidence. So this is very significant. And why I want to juxtapose it to Miranda is this. It is an article of faith, and you heard a little bit of it today from Professor Kamisar, that one of the things that led to Miranda is that the Supreme Court became frustrated with the impossibility of applying a totality of the circumstances voluntariness test to whether the results of police interrogation would be admitted into evidence. That it was time-consuming. It ate up a lot of the court's docket. There were an enormous number of cases. You couldn't tell the difference. It was case by case, fact by fact. This is exactly the regime that courts are asked to apply to deciding whether a consent to a search was voluntary or not. It's exactly the same test, using exactly the same words. Was it voluntary based on the totality of the circumstances? And interestingly enough, we've been applying it for almost about as long as the Supreme Court had been applying a voluntariness test to police interrogation when Miranda was decided, approximately 30-some years. It's basically from the 1930s that the Supreme Court starts to get involved in questions of the voluntariness of confessions. It's 1973 in the case of Schneckloth against Bustamante that the Supreme Court officially declares that totality of the circumstances voluntariness is indeed the test to be applied in the Fourth Amendment context. Now, why don't we have in the Fourth Amendment context the simple prophylactic rule that the Supreme Court came up with in Miranda? Why don't we find today that the courts can't cope with this kind of decision making? Why hasn't the Supreme Court felt compelled to substitute a prophylactic rule that would make the fact-finding as simple in these cases as it is in Miranda? Why not simply require the police to say before they ask for consent to search, well, you know, you have a right to refuse, but, and get the guy to sign a form. It wouldn't be named after Miranda, call it a Lynch form or something, that they'd have to sign. The same philosophical problems abound, the same issue about is there ever an unconstrained consent to search. I suspect there are at least some people who do want to confess affirmatively because they want to get something off their chest. I'm not sure there's anybody who has an affirmative desire to have the police go through their stuff. I think all of those consent searches are somewhat peculiar when seen as the product of some kind of free will. So why aren't the courts rebelling under the pressure of this regime? Well, I'm going to suggest a few reasons, and I'm not really trying to make any kind of normative argument here about what the rule should be or what the Constitution requires. I'm just trying to understand what really drives the Miranda decision, and I'm afraid by the end the answer is going to be not too surprising. First, I think it's worth noting that the courts aren't really consulted in this matter. It wasn't the courts, as some kind of collective, that rebelled at determining the voluntariness of confessions case by case. It was the Supreme Court that rebelled at the burden of reviewing those decisions. Now, that's interesting, because if there's anything that's voluntary in this world, it's the Supreme Court's choice about what it's going to review and not review. That's true as a technical legal matter. They have the certiorari jurisdiction, and it's also true in terms of how they exercise it. There are things they're interested in, things they're not. The Supreme Court perhaps didn't need, in some sense. It wasn't compelled to do all of that review. And the fact is, in the context of Fourth Amendment consent searches over the last 35 years or so, the Supreme Court has not felt compelled to look at and review all of these, or essentially any. There are a couple of stray decisions, but they've hardly reviewed any of these voluntariness cases in the Fourth Amendment context. Let me point out a few reasons that I think this might be true, or why the court might be doing this. First, and this goes to something that Professor Thomas talked about, indeed made the centerpiece of his talk, coerced confessions are widely understood and were understood at the time of Miranda to pose a risk not simply of unethical or abusive state behavior, but an actual risk of unjust convictions. As we've recently been reminded in the debate over torture, compelled confessions may be not just distasteful, but inaccurate. And as cases like the Central Park jogger case that George referred to also have recalled to us, this unreliability can appear not only in cases of overt torture, but even in response to milder pressure tactics. And one concern I have with Professor Thomas's question, I think it's the right question, what police tactics present an unacceptably high risk of producing false confessions, is we don't actually know the answer to that. It is reasonable to think that as you ratchet up the pressure, as you go to physical torture, people will more likely say just anything, but we know that it's the case that lesser pressures can also produce false confessions, and it's very difficult to know in any sound way where that risk reaches any particular level of likelihood, still less when that likelihood is unreasonably or unacceptably high. In contrast, though, the evidence obtained in a coerced search is generally physical evidence that is highly reliable. If the gun or the drugs turn out to be there, that evidence is just as probative of the defendant's guilt, whether the search is the product of freely given consent or of some kind of coercion. So I agree that one of the concerns that led to Miranda, one of the concerns that led the court to be concerned with the interrogation room is a concern for false confessions, and that concern is less present in the case of voluntary or involuntary consents to search. Secondly, the in-custody station house interrogation is the home of the third degree. It's in that black hole. It's inside the police station. Most in-custody interrogations, as the Supreme Court noted in Miranda, take place on the home turf of the police, away from any civilian witnesses, under the complete control of law enforcement. And abuse thrives in a situation of uncontrolled power. Not only that, the Supreme Court had faced a history of such abuse. Now, consent searches, in contrast, are less frequently, I don't think this is an absolute distinction, but they are less frequently the product of extended pressure at police headquarters. This is not to say that the police are not typically in control of the situation when consent to search is sought. But the most common consent scenarios take place on the streets or even at the suspect's home. Quite often other civilians are present, including sometimes the suspect's friends or family members. And whatever pressure to consent is applied, it has to take effect on the spot in a relatively brief window of opportunity. There's typically not an extended dialogue or interrogation to get that consent. If the consent isn't gotten right away, it's probably not going to be gotten at all. The court may believe that abusive conduct or may have believed that abusive conduct is less common in those circumstances. Maybe the consent isn't freely given. Maybe it's a submission to an expectation that there's an authority figure there who is going to search anyway or has a right to search anyway. But I suspect there's less practice, and probably always was less practice, I'll get to that in a second, of kind of beating a consent to search out of somebody when there is a history of beating confessions out of people. Third, the historical circumstances have to be taken into account. Professor Thomas is right. Miranda is a product of its time. It makes me wonder why we're shouting quite so loud about it today. It is something that, after all, happened 40 years ago. What's the difference between Miranda and Schneckloth? Well, in part, it's a simple observation. The political atmosphere and the composition of the court changed between Miranda in 1966 and Schneckloth in 1973, and it changed in part as a result of the Warren Court's criminal procedure decisions that became a political issue and contributed to the election of Richard Nixon in 1968 and the change in the court's personnel that followed. But there's more to it than that. As I've already suggested, the court's perception of a long history of police interrogation abuse, fueled as far back as the Wickersham Report on the third degree tactic, and a number of well-known cases of railroaded black defendants, particularly in rape cases before racist courts in the South, helped to contribute to this perception. I doubt that such a history existed in the context of consent searches, not only because of the factors I've already pointed out, but notice it's got to do with the Warren Court's decisions. Before the Warren Court, the local police had little incentive to seek, let alone to coerce, a suspect's consent to search. If they wanted to search, they could just go ahead and do it. It was only with Map Against Ohio and the application of the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule to the states that the police needed to worry about justifying their search and seizure practices in court. To the extent that the police abused the Fourth Amendment in the perceived bad old days, consent was not the vehicle of such abuse. They just went ahead and did it. Professor Kamisar reminded us before we came on the stage here of a story that my late colleague Richard Uviller used to tell, that he was a prosecutor when a Map Against Ohio came down. He went to a state police convention to instruct people about Map Against Ohio and its effects, and the police all wanted to know about this thing like Fourth Amendment law because they didn't know any of it. They didn't know any of those rules because, absent the exclusionary rule, they didn't have to follow them. So by the time of Schneckloth against Bustamante, the police reliance on consent searches was relatively new. And the social and legal safeguards against police abuse had become much stronger. By the time the police are starting to have to worry about how do we get people to consent to search, I think there's already been a sea change in the way that police behavior is understood and the way that police compliance with law was seen, and that's a product in part of Miranda. Miranda itself, it's a kind of interesting thing, I think, that Miranda, a case not about consent searches, may have indirect effects, and this is something I'll conclude on in just a minute, that affects police behavior in general. Hopefully, things that have taken place in the last 30 years, 40 years, mean that there's less police abuse. But I think it also means, if you look at what's going on in the courts are, in fact, rubber-stamping consent searches. If you did a study like Professor Thomas's, what he did with Miranda decisions and read all the consent searches, I haven't. That's the thing about not being a professor anymore. I don't have to do that work. But I can predict, I think with some confidence, that it would show the same thing. It would show the courts just approve these consents all the time. Now, hopefully that's because there isn't so much abuse. But there's something else that means. If in the pre-Miranda period, the Supreme Court was throwing out confessions because of its perception of abuse, whether, I assume the abuse was taking place, but I don't know that it matters for this point. If the Supreme Court is throwing out a lot of confessions, then it's doing a lot of controversial things, and there's a lot of police-judicial conflict and a lot of public pressure as convictions are reversed and people that the public thought were guilty are turned loose. If there is now a greater atmosphere of trust of the police, deserved or not, and the courts are approving these consent searches, then there's less pressure on the courts to develop simple prophylactic rules. because they're not in a position where they're having to do these case-by-case reviews and decide that the police did the wrong thing and reverse convictions. It's partly that process that generates pressure for a simple rule that the police can comply with or can adapt to or can get around thus avoid future spectacles of police-judicial conflict. If that pressure isn't there, that may also, in the search context, that may also be a reason why a Miranda-type rule hasn't developed in the Fourth Amendment context. Now, this last point brings me back to Miranda itself and its significance. And again, I'm not trying to make normative points here. I'm just trying to look at what's happened over these 40 years. Miranda generated a huge political outcry with exaggerated arguments that the court was either ending public safety by encouraging criminals or perhaps was striking a blow for human liberty against police tyranny. We now know, with the advantage of 40 years of hindsight, that neither of those things was true. But it's not only the politicians and the public who are inclined to see law in somewhat cruder terms than I think appropriate. Academics and judges, too, sometimes see law as a more blunt instrument than it really is. And we want to ask a question which I think is somewhat unanswerable, like, has Miranda affected the rate of confessions, or has Miranda increased the rate at which innocent people avoid conviction, or has it decreased the rate at which the guilty are convicted? If Miranda hasn't reduced the rate of confessions, does that make it just a paper tiger, a sham protection that serves only to validate police coercion? I think these are legitimate questions, but they imply more power in the courts and more power in legal doctrine than the courts or legal doctrine actually have. No judicial decision solves a problem like police interrogation for us. A judicial decision is a starting point for a dialectic evolution. And to say it's a starting point is already artificial. The judicial decision is part of an ongoing dialectic between police practices, the courts, the legislature, the general public. It's a point in an evolution. And I think it expects much too much of a decision to say this made the revolution for good or ill. We see a parallel debate about other decisions of the Warren Court far more significant than Miranda. Think about Brown against Board of Education. There was a time when the Brown decision was seen as the key blow of the civil rights movement, as the beginning and perhaps the end of a movement for civil rights. Well, of course, we later came to realize that was wrong. That underemphasized the importance of the struggles, the political struggles of African-American people in the South and elsewhere as part of a political movement that changed society. But I think then we tended to overreact in the other direction and say, well, yeah, and this Brown against Board really didn't make any difference. It didn't actually integrate a single school. It didn't change anything. Well, I suspect that's not the answer you'd get. I know that's not the answer you get when you ask the African-American soldiers in the civil rights movement about the effect of Brown against Board. It wasn't the fact that Brown against Board somehow changed life in the South at the stroke of a pen, but it was a significant factor in invigorating that political movement. Miranda, I think, has survived because it helped to create a new equilibrium in which confessions and interrogation continue to be major factors in law enforcement, but in which abuse is less common than it was. I think it is the case. I don't think too many people actually doubt it, despite the black hole, despite the fact that we can't know for sure what goes on in those interrogation rooms. I don't think many people doubt that there is less abusive police behavior today than there was before Miranda. Is there trickery? Yes. but trickery is less dangerous, perhaps, to the creation of false confessions, and certainly less violent and less horrible than physical torture. And I don't think we don't hear the same kinds of stories from defendants who have every incentive to make things up, even certainly have an incentive to reveal to the courts if there's been abuse behavior. We don't hear the same kinds of stories we heard before. Is that because of Miranda? Of course not. It's not because of the Miranda decision itself in isolation as a single thing. It's because of a lot of decisions, including Miranda. It makes a difference that one of the first things that arrested people hear from the police is, you have a right. I think it's a little difficult, a little more difficult to get out the baseball bat after you've said that than it is in a situation in which that doesn't have to be said. If I were King, I'd probably require a similar warning in advance of police requests for consent to search. I'm not, and I express no view on whether that is or should be some implication of the constitutional norm. I'm sure that such a rule would reduce the number of consents, but probably for the same reason as we've seen with confessions, not necessarily by that much. But I think it's less necessary to have such a rule. And it's less necessary in part because of Miranda. What Miranda does accomplish, not alone, but in combination with other warrant court decisions, and not simply as a judicial decree either, but as the Supreme Court recognized in Dickerson, also because it's part of the popular culture. What Miranda has done is to help to create an atmosphere in which police respect for the rights of defendants is a more accepted value and a more respected value than it was in earlier generations. The Supreme Court was not forced to do any of this by some inexorable pressure of judicial efficiency. It chose to do it, and it had an impact that reverberates to this day, and I think that's something that is worth celebrating. Happy birthday, Mr. Miranda.
Well, I'd like to thank our four distinguished speakers for those excellent presentations. We have about 35 minutes left for questions and answers. I have a couple in mind. I'm sure there's some in the audience. But first, Professor Kamisar has requested a few minutes to rebut Professor Allen's comments.
You know what the word few means, Yale?
You want to do up here?
Yeah. Well, you know, he made a powerful set of arguments, and I'm going to take me more than a few minutes to rebut, but I do want to say a few things, and hopefully other panelists might jump in. First of all, to go back to my original unvarnished statement, which was toned down, what I said was, and I say it again, in all the thousands of occasions where judges had to decide the admissibility of a confession, I don't think once any knowledge of or interest in freedom of will versus determinism helped them decide one iota. And I think we can talk about what the judges are writing and what they're saying, but what they were doing, and I go to the book by Josh Dressler and Alan Michaels, although the various language implies that voluntariness is an empirical question, it's simply and really a normative question, how much and what kind of pressure is permissible. And that's what they were doing. Nothing to do with freedom of will or voluntariness. That was just the way they wrote the opinion. All right. Now, Professor Allen says, where does this crazy Miranda come from? Where in the Constitution is it? It's not in the self-incrimination clause. Well, my response is, where in the world did the voluntariness test come from? You look at the Constitution, it doesn't mention voluntary, it doesn't mention coercion, it doesn't mention breaking the will, it doesn't mention overbearing the will. Where did it come from? And isn't it interesting that for 30 years nobody ask that question, because the establishment liked that rule. And the establishment went nuts when they realized that Miranda, something like Miranda was going to happen. Now, I was there when it happened. I was on the original advisory committee to the American Law Institute. The establishment, I mean by that, Breitel, Learned Hand, Henry Friendly, they were scared to death. The American Law Institute was set up to head off the Supreme Court. And so they liked this rule. It's a terrible rule. And Harlan and Clark dissented in Miranda and said the old voluntary test was fine, worked fine. It effectively protected the suspect. Well, who dissented in the Davis case? 16 days. All right, 45 minutes a day. 16 days of detention and questioning, and he never saw anybody. And who dissented in the Davis case and said, this is a voluntary confession? Harlan and Clark, two of the guys who dissented in Miranda, and said the voluntariness test was fine. Now, you can say the voluntariness test came from the old English rule that under certain circumstances, the confession looked unreliable, and they made that part of the Constitution. The trouble is, as early as 1949 and 1950, the court made it clear that they were throwing out confessions, even though there was no question that the confession was corroborated. They were throwing it out because, as Frankfurter said, it offends our sense of fair play. Where in the Constitution did that come from? Nobody seemed to mind. This crazy voluntariness test just came along for 30 years, and nobody questioned its ancestry. Now, and then where did the rule of automatic reversal come from? I mean, the court had a rule for about 40 years that no matter how much evidence of guilt, you had 10 bishops testifying the guy did it in front of me, if a confession was admitted, which should not have been admitted, because it was an involuntary confession, the case had to be thrown out. The rule of automatic reversal. Where in the Constitution does that come from? As for the original meaning of the Fifth Amendment, look, there were no detectives in 1790. There were no police in 1790. They were just night watchmen. There were no trained interrogators. I mean, how can you even look for the original meaning? It's so absurd to think about the original meaning. It's a different world entirely. And if you want to look at the original meaning, the magistrates were doing the interrogation, and 100 years later, the police started doing it. And if magistrates interrogating suspects is inconsistent with the Fifth Amendment, then so is what happened later when the police replaced the magistrates. All right, let me just end with this point. Alan talks about the legal mind that can think of something related to something else without thinking it's related to the same thing. Here is the world before Miranda. Colonel North can testify in front of a congressional committee with his friends sitting behind him on national TV, and yet he can confer with his lawyer before he answers any question. It got to the point where the committee said, hey, look, can't you answer anything without conferring with your lawyer? And the lawyer said, what am I, a potted plant? Okay. Now, you tell me what makes sense. What is connected and what is not connected? The guy in the police station is all alone. He hasn't got a lawyer. He's not on TV. He's surrounded by three or four cops. And the privilege against self-incrimination doesn't apply, but it applies to Colonel North on national TV. Why doesn't the privilege against self-incrimination apply? What was the reason? The reason was that the police had no lawful authority to compel an answer. And the privilege only applies when the police have lawful authority. The trouble with that is, the police didn't tell anybody they didn't have lawful authority. The police acted as if they had lawful authority, and they got answers under the color of their lawful authority. So it seems to me that it was bizarre to say that Colonel North had the privilege against self-incrimination to protect him, but the people in the back room of the police station did not.
Just to start the conversation going, I note that, first of all, I'm glad to see that the level of energy has risen noticeably, Yale, so I've served my primary purpose for being here. But secondly, I noticed that he didn't answer my question. What's the theory of interpretation that gets you there? What he said is there are other problems of interpretation. Okay, I agree with that, but what's yours? How do you get to the situation where a guy walks into the station house and says, he's arrested, and he wants to talk, and he makes a statement in response to a question, and that's thrown out? There's no compulsion whatsoever in any serious meaning of the term. Miranda applies that. How do you get there?
I can tell you. You asked me.
Well, I'm not asking you. I'm talking to you. I mean, it's really, really, really weird. And the game that's being played here is that it's the same game that skeptics play. You know, you find ambiguity somewhere and you allege it's everywhere. You know, no matter what you do with the Constitution, there are going to be ambiguities in interpretation. That's true. But there's going to be more and there's going to be less. The warnings and waiver regime is a really far distance from a voluntariness standard when you look at language of compelled self-incrimination. It's perfectly sensible to think of that phrase as referring to barbaric police behavior, because you simply don't want the government to exercise arbitrary authority of a certain kind without certain procedures followed, you know, like beating people without convictions and so on. And it's perfect.
Excuse me, Ron, weren't you saying before that you would favor a judicially crafted rule that created a presumption
of
coercion under certain circumstances?
Absolutely. As an evidentiary matter, I would.
Oh, but as an evidentiary matter.
But let me just, I'm sorry.
Let me, I'm going to
finish.
He's a judge, man. Remember?
He's on this panel. But now you take it worked. It took me out of my.
Nothing takes thoughts. You out of your rhythm. All right, go ahead.
Exactly. Right. So in any event, it's perfectly sensible to think of that language meaning just what I was about to say: barbaric treatment and treatment that might lead to a to an untruthful confession. That's perfectly sensible and very close to the language of compelled self-incrimination. The warnings and waiver regime is a very far distance from it. Now I said before, I don't care if Miranda's overruled or not, but it's very interesting that there's no answer to this question: what your general theory is. And what theory would you apply to justify Miranda that you'll apply when you have a court made up of very many different people? And if you don't have an answer to that question, you don't have a theory, and I think you have a constitutional problem.
Charlie, can I have 1 minute?
Sure.
Can Judge Lynch?
I don't want to get involved in that debate. What interests me is the black box phenomenon, and Judge Lynch had an interesting thing to say about what he sees in his courtroom, which is not very many stories. I mean, look, a black box is a black box, or a black hole is a black hole. The suspect can lie just as easily as the police. And when I read the 212 cases drawn at random involving Miranda issues, I expected to find some pretty outlandish stories of police coercion. I mean, you can make it up, right? It doesn't have to be true. And I only found one out of 212 story of anything approaching the third degree. So whether it was caused by Miranda or not, we do seem to be living in a more civilized age in terms of police interrogation.
Judge Lynch, what were you about to say?
Oh, well, I think there's one of the tragedies of constitutional law as it's taught in law schools over the last generation or so is that the criminal procedure cases have dropped out of the constitutional law course and into a separate course. While I think this is, it just can't be the place to debate broad theories of constitutional interpretation on this panel, I think that Professor Allen raises a significant question that would be useful in constitutional law courses. And I think the usefulness works in both ways. I think on the one hand, the constitutional criminal procedure cases suffer because they are not treated as typical issues of constitutional interpretation. They're treated as, here's our rule, which comes from some case, and now we're going to figure out some minute elaboration on that rule, rather than asking a question the way it would be asked in other constitutional contexts. But I think it's also the case that the general constitutional jurisprudence suffers by having these criminal cases taken away, because they provide, and Professor Kamisar gave a good example of it, some of the textbook cases of the way in which current problems change the meaning of the Constitution because we can't sensibly ask a question like, what would the framers of the Fourth Amendment think about NSA surveillance? What would the framers of the Fourth Amendment think about wiretapping? Indeed, what would the framers of the Fifth Amendment think about police interrogation? These concepts didn't have meaning for them because they were in a world in which those things didn't exist, and that forces one to have a more complex theory of constitutional interpretation, it seems to me, and it would be very useful to bring that dialogue back to both fields.
There's somebody who has his hand up, but I'll just speak one more time, and I'll shut up for the next 20 minutes, I promise.
Really?
Yeah, I promise. All right, I promise. No matter what you say. All right, but first, let me respond to this one question hypo that I've been hearing for 40 years. You know, the guy walks in and the cop says, "Did you kill your wife?" The guy says, "Yes." "What's wrong with that?" "Okay, I'll tell you what's wrong with that." It's the same thing that's wrong with the ticking bomb hypo. We know for certain that this guy knows where the bomb is that's going to blow up the Empire State Building. So what's so bad about torturing him, blah, blah, blah? The problem is, in the real world, you don't know for certain. And in the real world, if you have the authority to do that, you torture 100 people, only one of whom probably really knows where the bomb is. Okay. Now, the one question hypo is this. It never happens. The reason it never happens is no cop, no interrogator would ever start out the first question, "Your name, so did you kill your wife?" It never happens that way. He warms him up. He cons him. He seduces him. It never would be one question. But now, if it were one question, then what about two questions? I was on the ALI committee where they said, let's allow a few questions. So how many do we allow? Well, we allow the questions until the questioning becomes persistent, or until the questioning becomes sustained. Oh, my God. We'll be spending 50 years trying to figure out what is persistent questioning as opposed to an occasional question. And that's why, although it's a great hypo, it doesn't really, it's not a real, real problem. So far as I know, it's never come up.
As the hypo was formed, he wasn't in custody, but I suppose we...
There's no problem. Yeah.
No, you can easily make it a hypothetical custody.
All right, well, I'm going to ask a question, but then as people want to ask questions from the audience, I'd ask that you come up to the one microphone we have and identify yourself before you ask a question. I will start off, though, by jumping off from the ticking time bomb scenario and the changing context that changed the Constitution in this respect. There's been several references to what is interrogation law going to look like 40 years from now, and what's happening right now, and connecting that to the war on terrorism debates that are happening right now. We just saw the President of the United States asking for greater flexibility in using coercive interrogation techniques against enemy combatants, and Congress giving it to him, including in the context of military commission trials, which could make use of that evidence. And also the war on terrorism, as we all know, is tearing down the wall between the U.S. soil context and the overseas national security context. So my question to throw to the panel is, are we as a society changing our view about the efficiency or the acceptability of mild forms of coercive interrogation being acceptable? And if we are in that context, what are the prospects for that bleeding into the domestic criminal law context down the road? What's going to happen?
I can't talk. Go ahead.
This is great. I finally shut him up. I think the question you asked is a very serious question. I mean, these doctrines that we talk about in the context of what we call constitutional criminal procedure are one of the important ingredients that define the boundary between the government and the citizen. And that boundary is it's a semi-permeable membrane. It's not it doesn't keep the world out, and it's constantly changing. That's the point that you're making, and it's changing rapidly as we sit here and speak. And it's changing in some, I think, ways in which you should be quite concerned about it. The tremendous assertions of executive authority, which are perfectly appropriate following 9/11, seem to have no end, and they should. I'm shocked that Congress signed off on some of the language that they did in the recent Guantanamo Bay case. I mean, that then creates, positive law permitting a further shift in that boundary that I'm referring to. And I think all I can say is I agree with you. These are matters of great concern.
Well, it has to believe
back, is the short answer, because in the long run, of course we've got a terrible enemy out there, but we've had terrible enemies out there before. We did through the Cold War, and that enemy did have nuclear weapons, and it did have spies in the State Department, and it was a more formidable enemy. And we will have other enemies, domestic, and we do. You know, of course, we've suffered through a terrible incident that's pretty unprecedented, but the likelihood that some guy will choose to plant a bomb in the New York subways, it seems to me, is not limited to somebody in Pakistan dreaming that up, and it's not limited to somebody who has a political or international cause. Some nut could come up with the same idea, and that nut is going to be dealt with by the NYPD, and the ticking bomb scenario doesn't have to involve somebody in Afghanistan. So the pressure becomes very great to use the same kind of tactics here. All I'd say in terms of prediction is that we may again be expecting a little too much of the Supreme Court, and we may be expecting too much, for good or ill, whether you favor or disfavor the Supreme Court's interventions in this. We saw what happened with Guantanamo, I think, and it's a perfect example of the way American government really works. Whatever the Supreme Court says, it's not the last word. There is further dialogue, there is further debate, there is further evolution, and ultimately it's going to be a political resolution, because that will determine who's on the Supreme Court and what they have to say. So we haven't seen the last of this, and we won't see the last of it if next year the Supreme Court declares everything Congress does unconstitutional or reaches the reverse conclusion. That won't be the end. That's just one part of this dialogue.
I have a question for Professor Allen. Would you feel better about Miranda if the court had held that custodial police interrogation was unconstitutional as it was then being practiced and abolished it and told the states to start experimenting with improving custodial police interrogation, and also told the states that thereafter their efforts to improve custodial police interrogation would be judged not under the judicial construct of the 14th Amendment's involuntary confession rule, but under the terminology of the only constitutional provision that directly addresses the problem of interrogation, the Fifth Amendment's prohibition against self-incrimination.
Well, I think there's a vicious rumor going around that my affections for Miranda are not appropriate. I just want to confess publicly, I just really like the case a lot. So, you know, I'm very happy to have Miranda on the books and in my book and selling books and all kinds of things. But to take your question quite seriously, what you're really asking is to make a judgment about a counterfactual world. What would the world be like if the court had done that? My guess is the world would probably be better. The world's not that bad, and largely because of the reasons that Professor Cambazar is complaining about, not me, that Miranda did not bring an end to confessions, which was the risk. And as Jerry Lynch was saying, you know, there's an equilibrium. It's probably an acceptable equilibrium. It's the defenders of Miranda that are complaining about that equilibrium, not those who think it's unjustified. My points I was making were analytical points. But to go to your question again, yeah, I think the world would have been an interesting one. It might have been better. I mean, what's remarkable about the post Miranda, the Miranda era and the post-Miranda era, it's pretty obvious to me what the solution should have been, not much as I don't like to engage in normative efforts, which is something like magisterial interrogation, a point I don't think you actually much disagree about. I mean, after all, what's wrong? A guy's accused, you have probable cause to think a person committed a crime. What's wrong with giving him counsel, calling him to the stand, He can exercise his rights if he or she chooses to. Let people draw whatever inferences they like. There are some details, like the unfairness of calling somebody to stand and then attacking their credibility on the basis of a prior record, and I think that's right. You'd have to control for that and not allow it. But when you step back from the Miranda debate and just look at this sort of afresh, why not do that? What's wrong with that? You're not compelling him to incriminate himself. You have the right to, you, the society, have the right to his evidence, like you have the right to every person's evidence. If he doesn't want to talk, he doesn't have to talk, but why not draw inferences, whatever you think are appropriate, from that? I think that would have been and would be a better regime to live in. Whether we would have gotten there if the court had done what you suggest, I don't know, but maybe we would have.
Judge Lynch wanted to respond.
Yeah, I wouldn't comment on whether that would be a better example of constitutional law, but in terms of creating an equilibrium, I read that decision. It's Furman against Georgia that you've just described. And I'm not sure that that regime was more successful in producing a stable, predictable body of law that people have come to live with than Miranda. Though I do note, in the long run, although the details are pretty horrendous, the Furman solution and non-solution and the legislative reactions produced a state of the world with respect to the death penalty that in very large terms, is surprisingly stable.
Go ahead.
First, I want to comment the panel on doing perfect work on all these fronts, and I want to suggest to Ron, which in a sense is a perfect follow-up to Larry's question, that there is a theory. It's my personal favorite, which is why I see it in Miranda, but I think it's there, which is Dickel's second look here, that essentially the court identified a problem, which is essentially how Larry framed it, that existing custodial interrogations were problematic and, in some sense, recognized the court's own inability to regulate that problem, that its own voluntariness standards were ineffective at providing clear guidance and effective regulation in the station house. And then suggested something needs to be done. They then provided perhaps a much too detailed script about one possible option. But I recall, and I gotta go back and read it, but there is a paragraph at the end that says states can try other stuff. In fact, it's much closer than Furman, although Furman's a little, you know, confusing, at inviting the states to explore other options. And given that over the last 40 years, no shortage of other options have been proposed, suggested, articulated. In some sense, I think what we take is an example of a fantastic application of one theory of constitutional interpretation that fails in application, not in theory. It turns out that all the states, for a variety of reasons, decided, you know what, that one script they gave us, that works well enough for us. And it may have been because of the very ambiguity in Miranda. The ones that were concerned about invasive interrogation say, well, Miranda will work great to shut this down. The states that were like, oh my God, Miranda, well, we can figure our way around it. And so it's very ambiguity allowed every state to embrace that and not pursue alternatives. And I guess I wonder, what's wrong with that as a theory, save for that it's created a lot of work and given us all jobs, but as theories go, it doesn't sound like works are better than the alternatives that are now more commonly made.
Well, Ron said I served my time and I could talk again, but...
You released him from prison.
All right, but...
But you're still on probation.
Well, the one thing that Larry Herman's suggestion would have done, it would have spared Miranda this ridicule and criticism of where do these warnings come from. And as Steve Schulhofer said, it's one of the most ironic things because the warnings were designed to tell the police how they could continue to interrogate people, and the court had been criticized severely in Escobedo for writing an opinion no one understood. And so the police said, just tell us what to do and we'll do it. I remember debating a district attorney in California who said, they want us to sing the Star Spangled Banner, we'll sing the Star Spangled Banner. They want us to sing the third stanza, we'll sing the third stanza. Well, they tell them what to do, and the reaction is, what if they come up telling us what to do? Where is that? Okay. So I do think that the warnings have never been understood as, in a sense, it's as if in Furman, the court had said, well, the model penal code deals with the death penalty, and we think that one way to satisfy us is to follow the Model Penal Code. And that would have been like the Miranda warnings. And what would have happened? I don't know. But I don't think the warnings are what really deserve, they don't deserve the criticism they got. And would the court have been better off saying, you figure it out and come back to us, which is what they did in Escobedo.
Well, I think the I just threw out a sentence in my talk because I discussed this elsewhere that I don't think equality can do the work that you want done here. Certainly, there's an egalitarian influence. Certainly, I would say that we should certainly think about these issues as we decide what we want to do, so on and so forth. But in this particular context, the argument of from equality is really quite bizarre, and it is exactly what I guess Professor Thomas read from Professor Cambazar's treatment of equality, which I also quoted some time before, which is that if we're going to let the wealthy get off, let's be egalitarian and let the poor get off. Now, look, the trouble with equality is you always have to decide equality in virtue of what? That is, what it is you're trying to equalize. So it doesn't tell you in advance what it is you're trying to equalize. The idea that we should increase the wrongful acquittals of the poor, just to make it equal to wrongful acquittals of the guilty, just strikes me as bizarre. I would think that what we'd want to say instead is it's too bad that the wealthy are not being convicted at an appropriate rate. And then what you ought to do is search for ways to bring that into a line if this is what your egalitarian impulse is. So that's why I just threw out. I don't think equality does the job that Dale thinks it. You once thought. I don't know what you think today, actually.
That it
doesn't do the job that you need to have done in this particular context. I mean, there are all kinds of poverty distinctions throughout the law, and they are regrettable. But the idea that we should reduce the deterrent efficacy of the criminal law, subject the rest of us to the increased predatory consequences of these individuals in order to vindicate some abstract notion of equality between the rich and the poor, that's when I would get off the bus and say, that's not what I mean by equality. Sorry.
I actually agree with Ron on that. Joe Grano said in his book, Truth, Confessions, and the Law, I think, that if the problem is we worry about the rich having lawyers in the interrogation room and the poor not having lawyers, we could just ban lawyers from the interrogation room, and then we have equality.
You know, there was a proposal by the American Law Institute, which was supported by Nick Katzenbach, who was then the Attorney General, that the police are allowed 4 hours to talk to people, to interrogate people, unless they ask for a lawyer. But if they ask for a lawyer and can afford a lawyer, the police have to back off. So I was at this annual meeting, and I got so outraged that I got up and proposed that the police have the right to question everybody, rich or poor, for 4 hours, whether they ask for a lawyer or not, just to be spiteful. And to my amazement, Judge Henry Friendly stood up and seconded the motion, and Bernard Weisberg, who was a great ACLU lawyer, came running over to me and said, "My God, it might pass. Withdraw your motion." And I had to withdraw my motion.
I think we have time for one more question, so I think a good one to end on would be to bring us back to where we are now. We spent some time back in 1966 and some time in 2046. Professor Allen quarreled with my contention that the original Miranda had been narrowed by subsequent rulings. I was wondering if I could get the panel to discuss just a little bit what exists of Miranda today? What are the exceptions that have been carved out? What happened in Dickerson? Did they really uphold Miranda, or was that disingenuous?
You know, there's no such thing as Miranda, and there's no such thing as any other case in the sense of something tangible. I mean, every case is a trapezoid. You can plausibly read it narrowly, and you could plausibly read it very broadly. So, you know, the same thing was true of Escobedo. And what happened was that the prosecutors and the police read Escobedo so narrowly that it was limited to a guy of Mexican extraction, you know, and so forth. And they said, well, we've learned to live with Escobedo, but don't expand it. Well, of course, their definition of Escobedo was the narrowest possible interpretation. And then the ACLU had a very broad reading of Escobedo. So the next case comes up, the ACLU says, my God, they've narrowed Escobedo. And the next case comes up, and the prosecutors say, my God, they broadened Escobedo. So, you know, that's the way it's always going to be, because there is no holding. There's only a zone. And I guess Alan can argue, well, you know, you can read Miranda very, very narrowly, but I guess I'm saying the whole opinion was not written as a holding. It was written as a code. It was written as a general set of guides, and it was clear that the original Miranda court would not have interpreted Miranda the way the Berger court did and the way the Rehnquist court did. That's all you can say. And I've often, you know, Ron is right that there's a lot of stuff in Miranda that's inconsistent, that is ragged. It's not a great opinion in terms of, you know, quality. But, you know, as Zechariah Chafee once said when he was defending Holmes against Alexander Michelson, you know, you don't write an opinion as a sole author. You don't write an opinion as a philosopher. You've got to hold on to at least four other votes. And in order to do that, you've got to put in a paragraph you don't want to put in. You've got to take out a paragraph you don't want to put in. And that's what happened in Miranda. That's why it's not, you know, and they just didn't follow through logically. And I just think, A, they didn't have the votes, and B, they thought they would revisit Miranda a year later or 2 years later and reinforce it and strengthen it. And 2 or 3 years later, the Miranda court was gone. Warren was gone. Fortas was gone. And Black and Douglas were gone. On board came Rehnquist and Berger. And you may say all you want about some appointees disappointing the president who appointed them, but those guys did not disappoint Nixon. They were exactly what Nixon wanted, and it was all over.
Well, I mean,
not all over, mostly over.
You're trying to throw me off my thoughts again. I just find this discourse. Remember, I mean, I think of myself as an analyst or a scientist. I just find this discourse so bizarre. Miranda was a 5-4 decision. In each of the justices who concurred in the majority, there might be 100 variables that each of them took into account, and those variables may differ dramatically over those 5 individuals. You take one of those variables and change it, and you can lose that vote. Okay? Now, to say that Miranda had this sort of settled, well-developed picture that we obviously knew what the court was doing is just, I just find that bizarre. It's just not true. It's not true in any sense. I don't think we ought to be behaving on the basis of things we know to be false. The next cases that come along change the variables. It's not a surprise that people change their votes. Moreover, the court's organic. The system is organic. The membership changes over time. That's part of the process. You inject a new individual to the court. You've now got to reaccommodate all these interests. That's what we have. So then to reduce this debate to a question of are the subsequent developments consistent with an idealized version of a single case is just bizarre. It reflects a complete misunderstanding of the actual process. It reflects a complete misunderstanding of what a case stands for. It shows no regard for the way in which the human mind operates and reaches decisions. I'm astonished by this, frankly.
On that legal real politic note, I think I'm going to thank the panel, and let's give them a round of applause.
spirit of the day.
Thank you all for coming.
Well, couldn't be much better than that, could it? That was a fantastic transcript, it really was.